welcome with us this afternoon students from Madison East High School. Would they please stand? It's good having you with us this afternoon. You may be seated. These students are here with our Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. The program invites students, high school students from around the state, to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they are sent briefs of the case that they will hear, and these students may engage in other activities relating to this case depending on their instructors. Ordinarily, they also meet at noon with a justice of the court, and I don't know if the Madison High School students arrived in time for that, but if not, perhaps one of these justices will come out and talk to you after the case if you have the time. Now, for those of you who did not get briefs, there's a synopsis of this case in the outer room of this chambers, and you're welcome to go get a synopsis, or if you raise your hand, the marshal will give one to you. So with that introduction of the Madison High School students, I want to introduce the members of the court to you. Starting in my extreme left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I'll call our case. And let's see, it's 03-3478-CR, State v. Derek Anderson. And arguing on behalf of Derek Anderson is Attorney Neil C. McGinn, Assistant Public Defender. Mr. McGinn?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, my name is Neil McGinn, and I represent the defendant, appellant Derek Anderson. The issue before the Court this afternoon is defining the limits of territorial jurisdiction in the state of Wisconsin. Specifically, in the context of a prosecution for first-degree intentional homicide, is it sufficient that the government show that the defendant formed the intent to kill in the state of Wisconsin? Or, as the government seems to suggest in its written filings, is it sufficient to show that the defendant formed the intent to kill in Wisconsin and committed an act in furtherance of that intent? Or is it necessary that the government show a full constituent element took place in the state of Wisconsin? The first possibility, that the state of Wisconsin can assume jurisdiction based on the formation of intent alone, seems to be conceded as insufficient by the government, and I think with good cause. For example, if I'm sitting in my Milwaukee office and I decide that my Aunt Lorraine in Los Angeles needs to be killed, I then get in my car, I drive cross-country, I purchase a weapon in Los Angeles and kill Aunt Lorraine, I don't think Wisconsin would assume jurisdiction under those facts. Or carrying it even a step further, if I'm sitting in my office in Chicago and I decide that Aunt Millie in Minneapolis needs to be killed and I form the intent to kill her and I jump in my car and I shoot up, I shouldn't say shoot up, I drive up I-94 get to Minneapolis, I purchase a gun and I kill Aunt Millie, certainly Wisconsin would not assume territorial jurisdiction under those facts, even though I have the intent to kill in the state of Wisconsin. The idea that our state government would impose criminal sanctions for thoughts alone is, pardon the pun, unthinkable. The Howard comment in the 1956 Wisconsin Law Review calls such a paradigm violative of all tradition. As I said, the government seems to concede that the formation of intent alone is insufficient to confer territorial jurisdiction and instead proposes a paradigm that allows for the formation of intent plus proof of an act done in furtherance of that intent. And clearly that's a more palatable theory under which Wisconsin could assume territorial jurisdiction.
It also adds an element to first-degree homicide, right?
I believe it does, Justice.
Yeah, isn't that a little bit inconsistent, then, in your view, to say they can prove intent, but the only way they can do it is to add an element to the crime?
I don't believe that the state's proposal is a good one. I think it is more palatable than acting on mens rea alone. And in fact, some states have that. California, for example, has a statute that tracks the wording that the state proposes very closely. But the problem is that that's not what our statute says. Our statute doesn't say intent plus an act in furtherance of. I think both sides agree that the determinative statute here is 93903 sub 1 sub A, which clearly states that in order for Wisconsin to have jurisdiction, it must be found that any of the constituent elements takes place in Wisconsin.
Counsel, would you agree that intent is a constituent element of the crime of intentional first-degree homicide?
I would say this. I would say that in order for a constituent element to take place, that there has to be conduct involved.
No, that wasn't my question to you. My question was, is intent a constituent element of first-degree homicide?
Respectfully, I would say that in the context of 93903, no.
It's not. Okay, what are the two elements that you see under 93903 that the state has to prove in order to get a conviction?
I think that there has to be a death-causing act, and there has to be an act done with intent to kill.
There's nothing in the statute that says an act done. It just says intent.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think the jury instruction does indicate that it's an act done with intent to kill.
Right, but the jury instructions are not the statutes, and they're not precedent. I'm just looking at what the statute says.
Well, the statute doesn't say what the elements are. The jury instruction typically tells us what those elements are.
Right, but it lists what must be proven by stating the definition, essentially, of first-degree homicide.
Correct.
Definition doesn't have that little piece in between, to my recollection.
I don't believe it does, but I also don't believe that intent can confer jurisdiction in a vacuum. I believe it has to be connected to some form of conduct.
My question really, or all of my questions really go to whether in a jurisdictional context, the state simply can't prove intent the way it would attempt to prove intent at trial by showing circumstantial evidence that could lead one to believe that the requisite intent was present. Why isn't that sufficient?
Well, I would say this. I would say that it's not sufficient to say that if you have merely intent, that's enough for territorial jurisdiction. If there is conduct that shows intent, then you're in the state's argument. You're saying, okay, we have shown that there's intent plus an act in furtherance showing that intent, and that's sufficient.
Any conduct? What type? Are you talking about you have to strike a blow in the state of Wisconsin, even though the person may be surviving? You have to do something, right?
Correct.
And what's the minimum?
Well, I think that under our current statutory scheme, the minimum is the death-causing act. The state has argued in various places that conduct and element are not equated, that you can have an element that exists outside of conduct.
If death is caused by blunt trauma, and I'll say hypothetically, not this case, the person is stabbed, but that didn't cause the death, then what? There's no question that the intent was there, right? In other words, if there's any act I just want to find out what you mean by.
Well, I think going back to People versus Werblow, which is Justice Cardozo's opinion, which says it has to be at least an attempt to commit the crime, that has to be there. But the problem is that doesn't fit within our statutory scheme, because our statutory scheme says that it has to be a constituent element taking place in Wisconsin. Now, on numerous occasions, references are made to other kinds of elements, like mental states, like statuses, but to suggest that Wisconsin could assume territorial jurisdiction based solely on either a mental status or just a person's status in terms of age, I think would result in just absurd results. For example, if my 13-year-old daughter decides that she's going to go with her friends down to Great America for a day of riding the rides or what have you, and God forbid she's sexually assaulted down in Illinois just across the Wisconsin border. Now, her status as a 13-year-old, that element of the crime, exists in Wisconsin, but certainly that would not give Wisconsin jurisdiction. It has to be tied to conduct. And that's what we're suggesting, that those kinds of elements don't grant Wisconsin jurisdiction unless they're tied to elements.
So what is the rule you want to come out of this case?
I believe that under the current statutory scheme, the state has to show that the defendant caused the death of his father in Wisconsin. Not that his father died in Wisconsin, but that evidence has to show that that death was caused, or the death-causing act occurred in Wisconsin. And I also believe that no such proof was offered at the preliminary hearing. No proof was offered that the defendant caused his father's death anywhere, much less in the state of Wisconsin. Judge Hugh, the trial judge who heard the preliminary hearing, listened to several days of testimony. He heard from 11 different witnesses. He reviewed 4 stipulations and 5 exhibits, and he ultimately concluded that there was an absence of, and I quote, evidence of any act, affirmative act, that occurs in this state that would be causal to Alan Carnac's death. And I think Judge Hugh was correct in his assessment of that evidence.
Is the state's theory sort of the flip side of subsection C in this statute?
Exactly. Actually, what the state wants to do is it wants to impute the language that's in sub C into sub A. And we've talked about whether or not this, we've gone back and forth, the government and the defense, on whether or not the language of the statute is clear and unambiguous on its face. Obviously, I believe it is clear and unambiguous on its face. But even if you don't accept that and you go to the legislative history and you look at when this law was passed in 1955, there are 2 different comments that are cited. One from 1950, which was attached to the Senate Bill 784, and the other is a 1953 note that's attached to the Assembly Bill 100. Now, and there is a difference between those 2 comments that I think is significant. The first comment, the 1950 comment, says that the new law merely restates the old law. But that law, that Senate Bill 784, never passed. It's Assembly Bill 100 that passed, and the note attached to that says that the new law substantially restated the old law. In other words, there's a recognition that the new law is, in fact, different. And obviously it is different. It's different on its face. The old law, the 353, 28, and 29, would have allowed the state to proceed on the theory that they're asking the court to accept today. The new law doesn't. And the new law is a change in the statute. The language was different. And I admit I'm not a legislator, but I think I can use common sense and suggest that if the legislature wanted the new law under 939 to be exactly the same as the old law under 353, 28, and 29, they could have used the same language. They could have used exactly the same language, and they chose not to do that. And I think we have to assume that they chose not to do that for a reason. I recently read a quote from one member of this court suggesting that if something ain't broke, you don't fix it. And I think that's what the legislature was looking at in terms of changing the statute. They could have used the exact same language. They chose not to.
Is this just a statutory interpretation case, or do you have any constitutional grounds?
Well, we have had some discussion about whether or not there's a constitutional basis on the venue, but I think ultimately it comes down to a statutory interpretation.
If it's just a statutory interpretation case, why don't you just take a look at the statute, argue Brown, say that the constituent element is ambiguous, get to the legislative history, and then get the public policy. If I recall, the Willoughby Court engaged in some public policy, and the public policy is there going to be a crime, in part, is there going to be a crime committed for which no one has jurisdiction to try or punish?
Well, a couple points. First of all, I think we are stuck with the law as it reads. And if this Court is going to accept the government's reading of that law, I think what you're doing is legislating. You're rewriting that law. That law doesn't say intent plus an act in furtherance of. And I also want to, you know, there's been this discussion. Judge Hugh did it at the preliminary hearing. There's some reference to it in the certification about this so-called perfect crime. And I don't think that's an accurate term. I don't think it should be bandied about in connection with this case for a couple reasons. One, first of all, since 1977, the state of North Carolina, in their Batdorf decision, the Supreme Court decision, has allowed for the presumption that death occurs where the body is found. Therefore, North Carolina would presumptively have jurisdiction over this crime.
Okay, so why did they dismiss this?
Well, that's not on this record, Justice Wilcox, but I can tell
curious.
You.
Curious.
Pardon me?
No, I'm just curious.
Well, I can tell you this. I can tell you that the original district attorney who made the decision to proceed with the prosecution passed away. His replacement chose not to pursue the prosecution. But clearly the dismissal in North Carolina was done without prejudice, and North Carolina does, in fact, maintain presumptive jurisdiction over this crime. Secondly, the government, in their own brief, suggests that if this Court rules in favor of the defendant and grants the relief that we're requesting, that they would seek a new charge and present new and unused evidence at a second preliminary hearing. And certainly they have that right under Twait and other cases from this Court to do that if they have additional evidence that shows that the defendant did the death causing act in the state of Wisconsin. So I think this talk of perfect crime is misplaced in this context.
But Counselor, North Carolina wasn't part of the problem in North Carolina is that the whole body wasn't in North Carolina?
Actually, I that's not on this record, but I will tell you that I believe that there were pieces of the skeletonized remains that were not found anywhere, but they did have substantial portions of head and torso found. I am not aware of any evidence that any body part was found in any other jurisdiction.
Thank you.
What if the rest of the body were found in South Carolina?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that either North Carolina or South Carolina would have jurisdiction in that. And I don't know South Carolina law, obviously, but I would assume that either jurisdiction would be able to pursue prosecution in that context. The point is that in Wisconsin, there is no body part. In fact, there's no act. As Judge Hugh repeatedly pointed out, there's no act showing that the defendant caused his father's death.
And if I could, I know that the state's argument is predicated on intent. And looking at the intent here, as I understand the state's theory, it's that obviously the death was planned in Wisconsin. Are we really talking intent here as intent is defined in the criminal code, or are we talking about premeditation?
Well, I think there is
under the state's theory.
I think there's a distinction between intent and premeditation, and that comes up in the context of Arizona's law, which defines premeditation in terms of acts, and the Willoughby decision, which references numerous acts that were done in preparation for and in planning for a homicide that was prosecuted by Arizona. I think when we are talking about the difference between premeditation and intent, that Wisconsin doesn't appear to have the same definition of intent that Arizona would have for premeditation. There don't appear to be facts or behaviors tied to that intent. And perhaps more importantly, looking at the evidence presented on this record, the evidence doesn't show any kind of premeditation plan, the kind of things that were cited in Willoughby or Werblow that showed a preparation or a scheme underway. And in that regard, I think one piece of evidence that has been repeatedly relied on by the government has to be discussed here today, and that is the phone call. The phone call, which appears to be the hook that the state uses to grant itself venue in Jefferson County. And I want to talk just a little bit about that phone call and what that phone call does and doesn't do. Evidence was presented that at 3:10 p.m., a phone call was received by Alan Karnak at his place of employment, and that phone call originated from the Karnak residence in Jefferson County. The only other discussion relative to that phone call concerns testimony by an individual by the name of Bill Connolly, Mr. Connolly being a longtime friend and coworker of Alan Karnak. Mr. Connolly has a conversation with Alan Karnak on that same day, July 2nd of 1998, at 3:45 or 3:55 as he originally told the police, but some 35 to 45 minutes after this phone call. And during that conversation, Mr. Connolly indicates that he observes that Mr. Karnak is extremely upset. He's very upset. And Mr. Karnak says two things. He says two things to Bill Connolly. He says, I got to fly out of here, and we may have to go to a funeral. It's significant in what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, I got a phone call. My son called me. I'm upset because of this phone call. There's no mention in the preliminary hearing testimony that links the degree of agitation of Alan Karnak with this phone call received some 35 to 45 minutes before the conversation with Bill Connolly.
What about that call goes towards Mr. Anderson's intent?
I don't think you can infer anything from that call. We keep talking about how this phone call is so significant. How do you infer? We have no idea what the content of that call was. We have instead a mere phone call that occurs 35 to 45 minutes before Mr. Karnak shows his agitation, and the fact is he doesn't mention the phone call when he talks about his agitation. The argument is that somehow this phone call set in motion a process, that it somehow lured Mr. Karnak away from his place of employment and lured him home. Well, he was going to leave in 5 or 15 minutes anyway, and he was going to go home anyway. How does that phone call at 3:15 cause him to leave at 3:45 or 3:55 and do anything other than what he was going to do anyway? The point is that the quality of the proof evidenced in that in the preliminary hearing from that phone call is just missing. It's wild and rank speculation. And while it's clear that at a preliminary hearing, the state's burden is not one of, it's not a great burden, it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, it still has to be some proof. It has to be proof of some facts, not speculation, not opportunity. We haven't gone so far, and I know that we won't go so far as to suggest that mere opportunity is sufficient to warrant the finding of probable cause. Bless you.
Were there any other phone calls referenced, or were there any visits or any alternative explanation for the being upset?
On this record, there are no other phone calls noted. There is nothing. There is just a void between the phone call at 3:10 and the degree of agitation at 3:45 or 3:55. But I think you have to be very careful there because we're getting very close to burden shifting. We're getting close to saying, okay, he had the opportunity, and since he hasn't presented any kind of alternative theory, we're going to assume, we're going to speculate now that, in fact, he's responsible.
Well, but can't reasonable inferences be drawn from the facts that are of record at that time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I don't believe that it's a reasonable inference that this phone call caused anything. I think it's just speculation. How is that phone call tied to either Mr. Karnak's degree of agitation? He doesn't mention it to Mr. Connolly. Mr. Connolly doesn't say anything about the phone call. In fact, he says that when Mr. Karnak mentioned that we may have to go to a funeral, he immediately associated that with a Army buddy of Mr. Karnak's who was ill in Minnesota. No reference to the defendant in this case, no reference to an earlier phone call, nothing.
Mr. McGinn, maybe I misstated or maybe I didn't make clear my question. Because when I asked you the question about how does that establish intent, you started talking about what the phone call caused. I'm still at the intent prong. How does the fact that there was a phone call establish one way or the other what the intent was of the caller?
I don't think that the existence of that phone call establishes anything. That's the point. We have no information about what the content of that call was and what, if anything, it caused. There's just no evidence on this record to show what that phone call did.
And the phone call, when combined with other things that are in the record, such as the map, that Mr. Connolly drew and gave to Mr. Karnak that day that ended up in a different family vehicle but with his son's fingerprint on it, does that add to the weight of the scales? Do we have to just look at one item or can't we take a combination of items that indicate intent?
Clearly, you can take the combination of items. I guess the question is, do those items combined show intent? Or do they show conduct constituting an element of the crime? And I don't believe that the presence of a fingerprint on a map that's found in a family car is significant of anything. I guess my point is if you add zero and zero, you still get zero.
Yeah, but you're isolating each one and discounting each piece of fact that there is and say, oh, look at this fact. Hey, it doesn't mean anything. Then you take another fact, say, oh, look at this fact, and it doesn't mean anything. But a combination of facts are often more important than any one fact would be standing alone or all of the facts would be standing alone. And I guess that's my question to you here because we're not looking at proof beyond a reasonable doubt in order to sustain a conviction. We're simply looking at the jurisdictional burden, which is significantly less.
I agree with everything you've said, but I respectfully disagree in terms of what those things add up to. Certainly all of those things can be taken together, but I still believe that if you have completely ambiguous evidence that points to no fact, doesn't tend to prove or disprove anything, that if you have several of those, you still don't tend to prove or disprove anything.
Well, you have a map with a thumbprint on it that must have been put on after the map was given to him and before he didn't show up at wherever he was and they found the car about a week later in a parking lot?
They found it in Sauk County, yes.
Okay, so it was found, you know.
Well, actually, I'm sorry to interrupt. The car was actually in Whitewater.
In Whitewater. Okay, I knew it was someplace. The truck was in Sauk County,
right.
I think. Okay, so you have those two things. You still don't have the body of Mr. Karnak, but you have those two things in a period of time after he went missing, and both of those things are tied to the son, isn't that true? The son was in the house and was the person who presumptively made that phone call since nobody else was there but him. Is that...
I'm not disagreeing that it's a reasonable inference that he made that call.
Okay, and that's just an inference. It certainly isn't proof. So I guess my question to you goes back to kind of where I started out here in that sometimes an individual act may be insufficient, but a combination of acts can weigh more than each individual act would weigh on its own. And there certainly are inferences from both of those items, aren't they?
May I finish?
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
I don't believe that that's a reasonable inference to conclude from the presence of a fingerprint on a map in a family car that everyone had access to that's found in a glove compartment that is somehow indicative that Mr. Anderson killed his father. I don't think you get there. I don't know how you get there. I mean, I was thinking about this on the way up. I was thinking about when I was a child and I used to watch the Disney programs, and I'd watch these pirate shows, and there was a, you know, there was always a treasure map that somehow that was valuable. Is that the suggestion, that somehow this map is valuable and that it was retained after he killed his father? I mean, there's just no... There's no...
You don't know if it was obtained before or after the act of the father's death, but you know that it was obtained sometime after the father left work that day because he got the map from Conley that day, and it was found sometime after the father went missing. And so, I mean, there are inferences from it. I agree with you that the proof is slight, but I also think it's not without inferences.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Marguerite M. Mueller, arguing for the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. This court can affirm the trial court's bindover order on either of two theories. First, the theory that's been discussed in my opponent's argument, that Wisconsin has territorial jurisdiction over a first-degree intentional homicide case where it can be shown that the defendant formed the intent to kill in Wisconsin and committed at least one act in this state in furtherance of that intent. Alternatively, this court can affirm the bindover order on a theory discussed in the state's brief, and admittedly not the theory under which the trial court proceeded, and that is that the evidence presented at the preliminary hearing and the reasonable inferences that are drawn from that evidence establish probable cause to believe not only that the defendant killed his father, but that he committed this crime within the state of Wisconsin. Although the issue that was certified by the Court of Appeals dealt with the territorial jurisdiction issue, I think that for at least one reason it makes more sense to flip the order of the issues and really talk about the evidence in this case because that points to the defendant, because obviously if my opponent is correct that there's insufficient evidence to prove that Derek Anderson killed his father, then the whole issue of territorial jurisdiction becomes really academic. And I think that in the course of that discussion, by the time this court has reviewed with me all of the evidence that the state believes shows circumstantially that the defendant killed his father in Wisconsin, that it becomes almost inevitable to conclude that the crime did occur, in fact, in this state. And I think Justice Rogensack hit the nail on the head when she said that you have to look at each piece of evidence not in a vacuum, but under the totality of the circumstances. Because admittedly, when you take little pieces of circumstantial evidence, standing alone, they might prove nothing. And I think that when we look at what Judge Hugh did here, we have to keep in mind that he did not have the advantage that we as appellate lawyers and an appellate court do, and that is the luxury of being able to go back and reread all of the testimony that was presented at the preliminary hearing and then sit down and mull over this evidence for a while and see where it leads. You've got a preliminary hearing that went over 2 days and covered 12 different witnesses, and Judge Hugh made his ruling on the spot without the benefit of briefs summarizing the evidence. And I'd like to take some time to talk about that evidence first. I think one of the critical pieces of circumstantial evidence is the location of the father's skeletal remains.
Ms. Waller, before you get into that, which of these two theories do you favor? Which one are you putting forth as the one that you feel should be adopted by the court?
Well, I would like to have my cake and eat it, too, and have the court decide on both theories. I think, actually, the more I have looked at this case, the stronger theory is simply the one that, not that the trial court adopted, that if you look at all of the evidence and the reasonable inferences, there certainly is probable cause to believe that this murder occurred in the state of Wisconsin, because any other theory is just not very plausible for reasons that I'll point out. However, I do think that this court can also affirm on the theory that territorial jurisdiction for first-degree intentional homicide simply requires formation of intent to kill, coupled by at least one overt act in this state in furtherance of that intent. So I think you can do it on both. And the reason the state would like the court to address the territorial jurisdiction issue is to provide some guidance to the prosecutor, defense counsel, and the trial court upon remand, so that the prosecutor knows, does he have to prove to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime in its totality occurred in this state?
In other words, we have two issues here, ultimately. One, bind over, which is a probable cause. And two, when you get to the jury for the trial, the state still has to prove jurisdiction. Is that right?
It's somewhat. At this point, because we're just reviewing the question of bind over, I don't think the prosecutor had to prove territorial jurisdiction beyond a reasonable doubt, just at the probable cause phase.
Okay, but at trial?
At trial, generally, territorial jurisdiction isn't an issue.
And well, generally, you find the body here, and generally, the person is here.
Correct. You don't have
generally, you don't have a problem.
Right. And if venue is raised, I think that the Wisconsin jury instruction, the standard instruction on venue, if the jury can answer that positive, you know, affirmatively, it will automatically mean that there's also territorial jurisdiction.
Is the jury going to get territorial jurisdiction here? Because you can figure the defendant is going to say there is no territorial jurisdiction, regardless of what happens today.
Correct, that he's going to argue that.
That's right.
And I
think it's a jury question?
It could be. It could be a special verdict. I've never seen it happen before, but this, like you said, is a very...
You probably have never seen a territorial jurisdiction case before.
That's correct.
All right. So we haven't do that. So you think it might be a special verdict for the jury?
It potentially could be. I mean, the Court of Appeals, I think, in Brown said that, generally speaking, the venue instruction is sufficient to take care of any problems with territorial jurisdiction. And that might be the case here, that if the parties argue about venue at trial, the jury gets this special instruction. And obviously, depending on how that statute reads, if they decide that the entire crime was committed in Jefferson County, then it necessarily follows that Wisconsin would have territorial jurisdiction.
And that's the basis of your bind-over argument, that not only was there some intent and an act done to further the intent, but your bind-over argument is that there's evidence sufficient to find probable cause that the father was killed in the state of Wisconsin. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Probable cause to believe that.
So then it would go further. The evidence is going to go further than just finding that he formed the intent and one overt act here.
Right. I think it does go further. That's not, however, the rationale that Judge Hugh used. But I think you're not limited by what his rationale was for binding over.
So before you give us the evidence, one more question.
Sure.
Ms. Muller. You concede, I gather, that just forming an intent in this state is not sufficient for jurisdiction. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why?
For a couple of reasons. One, I think it's just a practical reason that how do you ever prove that somebody had intent to kill except by conduct? Unless you're mind readers, and the jury is not a mind reader, the prosecutor is not a mind reader. As a practical matter, you need something. Also, if you take hypotheticals, and sometimes you don't realize that a position is maybe too hardline until you take hypotheticals, you have other constituent elements of crime such as statuses, which I think Mr. McGinn pointed out. And certainly, a person's status can be an element of a crime, but it would be foolish to say, okay, my daughter was sexually assaulted in Illinois because she's under the age of 16, and she's under the age of 16 in Wisconsin, and this is where she lives. Ergo, Wisconsin has jurisdiction. So that's two reasons, and I think there's also a question in my mind about whether it would be unnecessarily expanding jurisdiction to really be punishing a person simply for having evil thoughts, really, within the state of Wisconsin that don't go any further, that there's nothing else further done in this state.
But, Counselor, there's no crime if all you have is evil thoughts.
That's correct.
Okay, so, you know, you're backing them. I'm concerned about your position on this, which I think you might have gathered from my questions to opposing counsel. I had my clerk get the jury instructions for me after opposing counsel's statements, and, you know, there are two elements of the crime in the jury instruction. One, that you caused the death, and the other, that you did it with the intent to kill. And then I'll ask you the same question I asked him. Is intent an element of first-degree homicide?
I believe it is. Intent to kill.
All right. Yes. And is intent to kill a constituent element?
I believe that it is a constituent element, but that in order to actually prove jurisdiction, you do have to show some act in furtherance of that state.
You have to prove intent. I agree with you on that, but I'm having a very hard time understanding why you want to say an act in furtherance of that rather than a combination of circumstances which each standing by itself is not strong enough to show an intent to kill, but the combination may be. That's my concern, is that I think you limit yourself. If you're going to hang it on the phone call, I think you're going to have good arguments like you're having.
Well, we're not hanging it so totally on the phone call, fortunately.
Okay, what are you hanging it on, finally? your chance.
One of the pieces of evidence that I think is very persuasive is the location of the body, or the skeletal remains. It was not a complete body by that time. It's in North Carolina, 7 to 10 miles away from where the defendant had attended college. Now, you look at that and say, of all the places that the person, assuming it wasn't the defendant, could have decided to dispose of Alan Karnak's body, why did this person choose a location that was that close to where the son had attended college? I mean, it's no different than...
At what point the son is the murderer?
Pardon me?
To show that the son was the murderer.
A framing theory?
Yes.
Okay. I would think that if someone wanted to frame him, they could have done a lot better job than they did in this case, because he wasn't even charged with a crime until, I think it was 2001. So I think if you were really going under the framing theory, you could have done a lot more competent job.
Ms. Mueller,
here.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Anderson was ever at the location where the body was found?
Not in the preliminary hearing record, no, Your Honor. There is not.
And how does the fact that the body was located there go towards the issue of intent? Doesn't it go towards opportunity?
Well, it goes towards opportunity, certainly, but I think it goes towards intent when you find that the skull was bashed in and that it was obviously a homicide. So whoever killed Alan Karnak did it intentionally. So it goes to the intent of whoever.
But that goes to the condition of the body. How does the location in North Carolina go towards the evidence of intent?
I think it goes to intent because there's no reason Alan Karnak would have been. His body would have been found in North Carolina based on the evidence presented at the prelim unless he was involuntarily somehow removed to that location, because the evidence all shows that he and his family were just hours away from leaving on a 3 or 4 day vacation in Wisconsin, going the other direction, going north, and they were never seen alive again. And the last person to see them alive was admittedly the...
Maybe I'm not stating my question clearly. You have a body that ends up in North Carolina. We don't know how it got there. We don't know at this point who put it there. I think the assumption is that Mr. Anderson put it there, but we don't know who put it there. How does the location of the body in 7 to 10 miles away from his school show that Mr. Anderson evidenced an intent in Wisconsin to put it there? Aren't we missing a few pegs along the way?
Well, I think you have to, first of all, it's hard to separate the who did it from how it was done or where it was done, because once you say that, if you're making the assumption, and I was you know, going to go through some more evidence, once you make the assumption that Mr. Anderson was the person responsible, then I think the only plausible inference is that his father did not leave Wisconsin alive with him on a trip to North Carolina. Well, so that...
But we don't know that he went to North Carolina at all with Mr. Anderson at this point, do we?
No, and that's why I'm saying it's... You first have to, I think, find out whether you agree with the trial court that there was probable cause to believe that this defendant is, in fact, the person responsible for his father's death.
If I understand your argument, you are going to show us why there's probable cause to believe that he committed the murder in Wisconsin. And what you're doing by saying location is you're going to say that the inference can be drawn. I think this is what you're going to say, plus other things. The inference can be drawn. He did the killing in Wisconsin and removed the body to a place that he was familiar with, where he went to school. Is that the inference you want us to draw, at least by the time you finish here?
That's the inference, but I would make it, obviously, there's a lot more evidence.
That's right. But, I mean, that's, you're going to
the bottom line,
all this stuff.
The bottom line is that I was going to show you that it looks like Mr. Anderson, certainly there's probable cause to believe he did it. And then if you agree with that, then you have to look at the scenarios under which what's, you know, what we know from the preliminary examination. It's certainly a lot more plausible that this homicide occurred in Wisconsin than that it occurred in North Carolina.
Kick off the factors we're talking about. First, the body's in North Carolina where the defendant knows the area. Okay? What else?
Okay. Now, these are the factors that go mainly to the identity.
Okay.
Mr. Anderson was the person who set in motion the discovery of the truck that his family supposedly was in when they left to go to their cabin on July 2nd. The truck was not located in Sauk County until Mr. Anderson called a warden and told him that his family liked to scout certain areas around Mirror Lake for possible hunting. He gave him some tips on where he might be able to find the vehicle, and within 90 minutes, the warden had located this truck. Now, I think it's very unreasonable to assume that if Mr. Anderson really thought that this was a possible location, that he wouldn't have driven there himself to go look for this truck, since on July 6th, when he got worried about his parents, he drove all the way from the family's home up to Washera County to find out if they'd ever made it to their cabin. So he waits 4 days, and then he calls the game warden and says, why don't you go look, because the sheriff's department isn't being helpful. And I think one of the reasonable inferences to be drawn is that he couldn't go find the truck because then it would draw too much attention or suspicion to himself. And when the truck is found, it's completely cleaned out. There's no evidence of any fishing poles, luggage, anything that you, a family of three plus a dog, would take with them on a 3 or 4 day weekend to a cabin. The only thing basically in the truck is this little, you know, book that they kept a log of miles in, sitting on the front seat. No fingerprints even. So, I mean, whoever put the truck there, and, of course, it's the state's theory that it's Mr. Anderson who put the truck there. That's why he knew approximately he could tell the warden where to find it. Whoever took the truck there went to great pains to wipe away any kind of evidence of the family or anything else. Another piece of evidence is the thumbprint on the map, which I think Justice Rogensack zeroed in on as being suspicious. I think it's suspicious for a couple of different reasons. James Gradle, who gave the map to Mr. Karnak, I believe it was in the afternoon, early afternoon of July 2nd, testified that Mr. Karnak folded the map and put it into either a briefcase or a similar repository to take with him. Okay, we don't know for a fact which vehicle of the Karnak family's Alan Karnak was driving. We do know that the car in which the map was located was the Buick that was normally driven by his wife, Donna, and that Donna was at work that day. So first of all, you have to decide that it's more plausible he didn't have this car, but that his wife had the car on that particular day. Second, why would it make any sense to put a map that you're going to need in the next couple hours in the glove compartment of a car you're not taking to your cabin. So those two things are suspicious right there. The thumbprint of the defendant, the crime lab identified it, is being found on the map. The defendant never tells anybody about finding this map. It's found by the police after the car was totaled in Whitewater, and it's sitting over at a wrecker, and the map is found when they do an inventory. It's found in the glove compartment. At the same time, the preliminary hearing evidence shows that at some point, and of course there's no date specified, and I think as the court I'm sure appreciates, part of the problem with this case is that when disappearances occur in 1998 and you don't have the prelim until 2003, people's memories aren't going to be as sharp as they would have been had it been more contemporaneous with the disappearance. But at some point, the defendant called James Gradle to ask him what was on the map. He wanted to know about it. So I think all of those circumstances surrounding the map point to the defendant. Somehow, that map was taken out of the possession of Alan Karnak, who we know had it before his death. You've also got the fact that there were unexplained miles put on one of the Karnak vehicles. There was something like 2,600 miles put on the one truck in slightly less than a month, and the detectives measured and found that there were basically 1,560 miles round trip from where the family homestead was, the Karnak residence, to the location of this, where the skeletal remains were discovered. So there were plenty of miles on this truck, and one inference that you could draw, and again, we're only talking about needing to draw probable cause here, is that that truck was used to transport Alan Karnak's body from Jefferson County to where it was found in North Carolina. Another piece of evidence you have is this activity log that the defendant kept, or I should say he generated, at the behest of police. The police asked Derek Anderson if he would write out a log of what he did during that weekend when his parents and his brother disappeared. And I think if you look at that activity log, it's remarkable for some of the inconsistencies and also some of the omissions. He writes in his log for July 2nd, the day of the disappearance, a lot of very minute details, such as he returned a library book. He went out and bought some beer. He doesn't say anything about the phone call that he made to his father. And in fact, he only admits that he made the phone call in December of 1998 when his aunt specifically asks him, why did you call your father to come home that day? And at that point he says, I was looking for a tool and I needed to call him. So the fact that there's nothing mentioned in the log about the phone call is suspicious. Also, there's nothing mentioned in the log about Alan Karnak being upset or distressed about anything when he got home from work that day. And yet one of his friends, an acquaintance of, I think it was 20 years, Bill Connolly, testified he had never seen Alan Karnak that upset and that distressed as he did July 2nd at about 3:45. Well, according to the defendant's log, his father was home from work no later than 5 o'clock, and if he was that distressed, you'd think that it was something that he would be sharing with the family. Another thing in the log is that on July 5th, and this is when the defendant expected his parents to come home, he made some comment to the effect that, I expected them to be home before dark, but they weren't, and so I just assumed that they decided to stay an extra night and do some fishing. Well, then suddenly on July 6th, he becomes worried and says, I'm driving to the cabin because it's very unlike my parents not to call when they have any kind of a change in plans. And the same thing was echoed in the testimony of Mary Gay, who was the aunt of Derek Anderson and the sister of, I believe it was of the defendant, or, excuse me, of his father or the wife. I'm not sure which one. And then, of course, you have the phone call from work. I don't think there's any doubt that the phone call was made by Derek Anderson because the evidence showed that neither the brother Tom nor the wife Donna would have been home at that time. The content of the phone call, of course, we don't know. We know the phone call was made from the residence and that sometime after receiving the phone call, Mr. Karnak's demeanor completely changed.
Ms. Mohler, isn't the strongest evidence that the state has regarding the element of intent the conversation with Patricia Ellison? I mean, all the items that you just went through, there's a lot of opportunity and circumstance, but it's circumstantial evidence about the offense. I'm still looking for the intent that you say give Wisconsin the jurisdiction in this case. The one piece of evidence that seems to go towards intent is that conversation with Ms. Ellison. Should that conversation have been admitted by the trial court, A, for purposes of the preliminary hearing, and B, if it does come in under the residual exception or any other exception that you have, does it survive a Crawford analysis and can it be admitted to trial?
I think the Patricia Ellison testimony, had the trial court not decided to strike it at the end of the preliminary examination, was dynamite evidence for the state because Ms. Ellison testified that on April 17th of 1998, which would have been approximately 2.5 months before the family's disappearance, that she and the deceased were having a conversation at work where they were exchanging stories about their respective problems with their sons. And Alan Karnak asked her, well, has your son ever threatened you? And when she said no, he said, well, my son tried to club me over the head after work one night. And she was so appalled by this that she apparently told a lot of people about it. And she said at the preliminary hearing that when Alan Karnak related this, he was shaking and he was red in the face and he was just extremely frightened looking. And obviously, this would be incredibly good evidence because it would support the other acts evidence in the first place, showing that on a prior occasion, the defendant had attempted to use a club to hit his father over the head. And in fact, Alan Karnak later dies of blunt force trauma to the skull, and that it happened after work when he was waiting for him. And in fact, I think it's probably, you know, no secret that the state's theory here is that this is what happened in this particular case, that when the respective family members came home, somehow the defendant was able to do away with them.
Right, but the question is, would that evidence be admissible, one, at a preliminary hearing, and two, would it later be admissible at trial?
I think it would be admissible at the preliminary hearing under the residual hearsay exception for the reasons I set forth in my brief, and I think it would be admissible at trial without a Crawford problem because I don't think that a statement that a person makes to a non-law enforcement related person is testimonial under the definition in Crawford. And I don't have, since that wasn't an issue brief, I don't have cases right in front of me, but I could certainly submit them to the court. I think it's been repeatedly held by courts interpreting Crawford that this type of statement is not testimonial, so that you would simply use the Ohio versus Roberts test to see whether or not it had indicia of reliability.
You could use the Ohio versus
Roberts test. You wouldn't have to.
Or we could devise another test.
That's correct. I think that one way of reading Crawford is that if something's not testimonial, then you just let the state's hearsay rules govern admissibility, and that would be both at the preliminary hearing and at trial. So,
are there any other items of evidence that you think point to probable cause that this defendant committed a homicide in Wisconsin?
Well, I think that the evidence that I detailed shows why the state believes there's probable cause that he, as opposed to somebody else, did it. And then when I think if you look at the other possible alternatives, it makes a lot more sense to believe that these people never left in their truck than to think that somehow they left for the weekend and then the defendant would have to have followed them in a second vehicle, somehow been able to overpower not just the father whose body is found, but the other family members, because obviously his wife and son aren't going to sit by while the father gets clubbed over the head. And yet none of their possessions were ever found in the truck that they supposedly were leaving from the driveway to go to the cabin in. And also, I think just the whole idea that the defendant had the opportunity to do this, because from July 2nd at 5 p.m. until July 6th at 5 p.m., we're talking a period of about 96 hours, there's no indication in his activity logs that anybody saw him. It wasn't until he drove up to the cabin when he got worried, supposedly, to see if his parents had ever made it there, that he again surfaced. So he certainly had the opportunity to commit the crimes and to conceal the bodies, to conceal evidence of the offenses, because nobody was expecting these people to be back, and the place where they live is a somewhat secluded area, not, you know, in a subdivision where they've got houses right on top of each other. So for all of those reasons, I think the most plausible explanation, and again, we're only at the probable cause level, is that he did in fact kill his father and that the act causing death did occur in Wisconsin. Alternatively, for the reasons that I've discussed and that are in our brief, I think that if you don't agree with this, you can still bind over on the theory that all you need to show is formation of intent to kill and at least an act in furtherance of that intent. And just very briefly, I think one thing that I really failed to stress in my brief is that the current version of 939.03.1a supposedly is a substantial restatement of those two prior statutes, 353.28 and .29. I think if you look at the interpretation that the defense wants to put on it, it would actually be a repeal of 353.29 and a substantial restatement of .28, because .29 is the one that said that under the prior statute, if you intended to commit a crime and you did any act in Wisconsin in partial or complete execution of the intent, you could be prosecuted whether or not the completed crime occurred here or in another state. And I think really...
Isn't that what 939.03 sub...
This language... 939.03 subsection C? 1C talks about somebody who starts out being out of this state and doesn't act with intent that it caused a criminal consequence in a state. I think that's the type of thing where someone might be in Illinois and they shoot a gun across the border and kill somebody who's standing in Wisconsin. But in any event, I think that the defense interpretation would really be impliedly repealing and not simply restating 353.29.
What's the partial or complete execution here? Under 353.29.
I think that just getting the father to
get home,
come
the phone
home.
Call.
Right, the phone call.
Hey, thank
is
you.
There, was He's there...
Justice Prosser.
I'm sorry.
Did the defendant have an explanation of why he didn't join the family for the 4th of July outing?
No, there was never any explanation. I think there's certainly circumstantial evidence. You can kind of read between the lines in some of the testimony at the prelim that he maybe wasn't particularly close to his family. He changed his name right after the family's disappearance from Andrew Karnak to Derek Anderson and gave the explanation to his aunt that it was for some business-related purpose. But there's no explanation.
Defendant have an alibi for the period in which 2,600 miles was put on?
He just said he stayed at the home the whole time. That was his, that no one saw him, but he stayed at the home and went out and drove around on one of the days. But no alibi other than that.
I have one other question. In regard to the Buick, is there anything either favorable or unfavorable to your position about how it ended up being smashed?
I don't think the actual evidence of how it got turned over was actually in the prelim, and as far as I know, I don't think that's really relevant. I think it had to do with an OWI, not much.
Okay, thank you.
There was a vehicle found in Sauk County near,
that's correct.
Near Mirror Lake?
Correct. That was the truck that the defendant said his family members and dog left in to go to their cabin.
Well, presumably the state believes that he put the truck there.
That's correct.
How did he get from the truck back to Jefferson County?
That's a very good question, and there are plausible alternatives, one being he could have hitchhiked. It was, after all, the 4th of July weekend, and you get a lot of traffic. I hate to admit this, but having hitchhiked when I was a lot younger, it isn't that hard to get a ride. And that's one plausible explanation. Another possibility, and I'm not suggesting that we have this evidence, it's just if you're looking for an explanation, if he had access to a motorcycle, it certainly isn't that difficult to put a motorcycle into the bed of a truck and then take it off and ride the motorcycle away from the scene. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moeller. Mr. McGinn?
Thank you. I have just a couple of points to make. I'd like to start with the statute itself, 93903, and its relationship to the prior statute. The statute is what it is. It says any of the constituent elements taking place. And whether that amounts to a repeal, a substantial rewrite, it is what it is. It says what it says. And it is the statute that we're stuck with here today. I'd also like to point out both Justice Prosser and Justice Butler referred to subsection 1C of 93903. And I think it's important to note that the language in 1C is particularly different than that in 1A, in that 1A uses the phrase constituent elements taking place, whereas 1C, a subsection of the very same statute, uses language very much different and describes someone who does an act with intent. And I think you have to infer that if the legislature, in its wisdom, was able to put that language in sub 1C, they could very easily have put it in sub 1A, and they chose not to do that. I also think that a number of pieces of evidence have been discussed here today by the government as indicative of the idea that Mr. Anderson killed his father in Jefferson County, and that probable cause exists on this record to prove it, and that's the only plausible inference. Well, it wasn't plausible to Judge Hugh, and it wasn't plausible until we got to this level of the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin for the government to suggest that theory. And I think for good reason, that it isn't plausible to believe that Derek Anderson killed his father in Wisconsin or in Jefferson County. The evidence that has been presented does indicate an opportunity, perhaps, but certainly no concrete evidence to suggest that the defendant committed an act in Wisconsin that caused his father's death.
Doesn't take very much to show probable cause in the state to bind over.
That's understood. But I have to say that even though we have not a high standard, there still has to be some proof. There has to be some conduct shown. And on this record, it's just not there. We're talking about, and I think the government used the phrase more than once, you can assume this, you can assume that, you can speculate this. Sure, you can engage in those kind of mental gymnastics, but that's exactly what they are. They're mental gymnastics. They're attempting to weave parts that don't belong together into a whole that amounts to probable cause. And I don't think that's properly done in this case. Some of these arguments that are made about the fact that the defendant reported where his parents may have been scouting land, that's indicative of guilt? How is that indicative of guilt? He was looking to find his parents. The government actually went so far as to suggest in its argument today that there's probable cause to believe that he killed his mother and his brother as well. That all three people were dispatched by the defendant. I'm sorry, I can read that transcript 50 times, and I don't see that in there. I don't see there's evidence of the defendant acting and causing the death of his father or any other family members. The log that's referred to, it's not clear on this record when that log was compiled, when the defendant wrote it. And it's clearly doesn't detail every event that occurred during that weekend. But it does indicate that he was concerned enough about, worried enough about the disappearance of his parents that he did drive to Washera County to see. That's somehow consistent with his guilt. That's to be held against him.
McGinn, let me ask you the same questions I asked Ms. Mohler regarding Patricia Ellison's testimony, sure, because that seems to at least arguably establish a link for intent, given the circumstances of what she had indicated. Does that come in to a preliminary hearing under any exception to the hearsay rule? And if so, would it later be admissible for purposes of trial and survivor Crawford analysis?
Well, I think, first of all, I make 3 points in regards to Ms. Ellison's testimony. First being that the government should be held to a waiver bar in terms of making this novel argument here that under 908.04.5(6), this evidence comes in under the what my evidence professor used to call the prosecutor's kitchen sink exception. And he could say that because he was a prosecutor. But justification for admitting that evidence was never raised in the trial court. And typically when this court looks at whether or not evidence should be admitted, it typically looks at whether or not it was admitted, but admitted for the wrong reason. And the government will say, well, okay, it should have been admitted, but it should have been admitted for this reason. In this case, they're saying something completely different. They're saying it was wrong to admit it, and it was wrong for the wrong reason. So they're asking this court to ignore the ruling of the trial judge, and I think that the standard of review for this kind of decision is one of great deference, that unless it's shown that this is manifestly wrong, that Judge Hugh was manifestly wrong, and that this was an erroneous exercise of discretion, that the trial judge who's there hearing the testimony should be upheld. His discretionary ruling on the admissibility of hearsay testimony should be upheld. The fact of the matter is the state just disagrees with that ruling. The third point I'd like to make in regard to Patricia Ellison's testimony is that that testimony is obviously unreliable, that there are no circumstances that would point to its reliability. The conversation allegedly takes place on April 17th of 1998. The family goes missing in July, on the 4th of July weekend of 1998. This conversation is not brought to the attention of the police until early August of 1998, and it's not brought to the attention of the police by Ms. Ellison's initiative. It's brought because she talks about it with another person who then calls the police, and the police then contact Ms. Ellison. And when the police contact Ms. Ellison, what she says is she can't really remember much of what happened. In fact, the only thing she remembers in that initial conversation with the police in August is that Mr. Karnak had said, it's not good when your son threatens you. She doesn't mention anything about being attacked with a bat or laying in wait or this other thing about at least you know how you're going to die. She doesn't mention that when the police talk to her because she has blocked it out. And then somehow down the road she miraculously remembers that these other parts of the conversation. I would suggest that that hardly indicates some sort of circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. As to the last point, Justice Butler, regarding the Crawford analysis, I don't believe that this would qualify as testimonial evidence, and therefore a Crawford analysis would not be necessary. We would look at it under the Ohio versus Roberts rationale, which would result in its inadmissibility.
Thank you, Mr. McGinn, and thank you, Ms. Mohler, for your arguments on an unusual fact situation, an unusual legal issue to come before this court. And that ends our hearing on 03-3478 CR, State versus Derek Anderson. Now, let me just ask the students a question. Are you all leaving immediately, or are you able to stay for a few moments? Okay, so some of you will stay. Show of hands of those staying. Okay, thank you. Ms. Justice Patience Robinsack will be out and talk to you in a few minutes, and all those who wish to stay for that discussion will do so. We are adjourned. The court will meet.